And 107.5 FM, W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. She'll sign it immediately, says Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, of the bill passed today that repeals the state's Civil War-era abortion ban.
This is something that is motivating voters up and down the ballot because Arizonans are outraged about the government and politicians in their personal health care decisions.
This is Florida's six-week abortion ban went into effect today. Remaining closed for the second day in a row, Portland State University, a group of protesters refusing to leave a campus library, demanding the university sever ties with Boeing, claiming it provided weapons to Israel. Former whistleblower who worked as an auditor at Spirit AeroSystems, the company that makes the 737 fuselage, has died 2 weeks after getting an infection. Seattle Times reports Joshua Dean was fired a year ago after he alleged serious and gross misconduct by senior quality management. A section of a highway collapsed after heavy rains in southern China. Many deaths. This is ABC News.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Police in riot gear moved in on protesters at the UW-Madison campus Wednesday morning. Police started arresting protesters and escorting them off Library Mall after 8 in the morning. Hundreds of protesters, mostly students, are calling on the UW to cut ties with Israel. One in five Americans age 50 and older has no retirement savings. That's according to a new study from the AARP. Spokesman Jim Flaherty says while it's wise to save for retirement, it's not always easy.
A lot of times because they're just trying to get by and they do have to live paycheck to paycheck. But this is one way to say, hey, if you can live with a little bit less from your paycheck every week, that will sure grow.
Some states have state-operated retirement savings programs, but not Wisconsin. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke here, bringing you the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings on WLAK. This isn't just for farmers, people. It's for anybody that enjoys food. Tune in 5 a.m. on Lake Air 1260 WLAK Amory.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Evidently, there was a little dinner party. I'm going to call it the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act dinner party. Elon Musk and David Sachs, a couple of billionaires, brought together some other billionaires, some of the most powerful business leaders in the country, to David Sachs's $23 million, 11,000 square foot home in Hollywood Hills. For a little powwow, a little get-together, a little strategy session, little vino, a little opportunity to, well, you know, slice and dice up the country for them. Interestingly enough, some of the names on there that are reported to have attended, Rupert Murdoch, the billionaire, former Fox guy, Peter Thiel, you had Steve Mnuchin, you had Travis Kalanick, you had a bunch of folks. Michael Milken, the junk bond king, pardoned by Trump. A lot of interest in ensuring that Trump gets back in, and more importantly, making sure that their tax cuts are safe from the evil Joe Biden. And you know, this is the thing that gets me. This is the simple math. They finally have a tax code that they kind of like, because they can have all the money and none of the responsibilities. And the weird thing is this is where, if you think about it, in a functional society with functional wealthy people, you know, if you're going to have a benevolent dictator, they kind of have to be benevolent. And I know they set up philanthropic operations so that they don't ever have to pay taxes and kids and family members can have jobs forever. It's a really good racket if you can get it. But these guys could. They could solve problems. I mean, these kind of dinners, if you really thought about it, because the right loves to talk about the Bilderbergs and the Rothschilds and the Illuminati and all of these secret organizations that are, you know, trying to make one world government. And a lot of these groups do exist, but they at least pretend to have the high-minded view of how to solve problems. This isn't any of this. This is, hey, how do we keep more for us? Any one of these people at this dinner party could solve a problem. You could end childhood hunger in this country. You could end veteran homelessness. You could do all kinds of things. They choose not to. Because again, I've had people tell me, well, you know, they've got more money than they know what to do with. And you go, yeah, but it's not about the money for them. It's about what the money says. It's that status. It's where they view themselves in the pecking order of humanity, which is at the very top, better than everyone else. And you, me, everyone else, we're disposable in that world. Which is why it was interesting that Tesla, who is, you know, the most valued car company in the country, in the world, they just decided, well, we're going to lay off 10% of the workforce. Now, these are people who showered at work. They slept in their cars. They sacrificed. Because remember, Elon went and laid a bunch of people off, like at Twitter, got rid of, you know, most of the people that worked there. And said, well, you're just going to have to work harder. So what they want is they want you to work harder, longer, dedicate your life to them and their vision, but you get none of the rewards of it. Now, the reason I bring this up is I had a really interesting conversation today. A nice saleswoman that I happened to be next to at a conference was saying, you know, we can't find good people. Nobody wants to work anymore. And her job is, as a salesperson, it's a catch and eat kind of job. You have to go out there and you have to hustle and you have to do all kinds of things. And if no sales comes in, sorry, you don't make anything. Now, she's had years to build a clientele. She's had years to establish herself to where, you know, people come to her now. But they're surprised that nobody wants to do this kind of work anymore. Nobody wants to take on that kind of risk anymore. And, you know, I was explaining to her that, you know, look, you know, when I don't blame Gen Z for not taking crummy jobs for crummy wages. I don't. I actually understand it. And, you know, as I said to her, I go, you know, do you believe the company that you work for cares about you? Because I look at Elon Musk, I look at Tesla, I look at these folks who, quite frankly, they don't care about their workers. They don't care about the people who make them the billions of dollars that they have. They don't. And this is where politically working people have to know which side they're on. And it's the age old question for workers. Which side are you on? Are you on the side of the bosses and the billionaire class who don't care about you? Thus Donald Trump. And playing footsie with Donald Trump and wearing the red hat and spewing the language. Now look, Sean Fain, the head of the UAW, was very clear. I'm not meeting with the guy who's the problem. I'm not meeting with the billionaire who's part of the billionaire class, who's making the working class's life miserable. That is the response across the board. And for working people, we've got to be the ones that come up and say that loudly. Donald Trump is the problem. His class is the problem. The fact that you had this dinner of the billionaire class coming together to figure out how they're going to defeat Joe Biden, who has been the most pro-union president in my lifetime, the most pro-worker president of my lifetime. The billionaire class, they're not happy. Why? They don't want to share. They don't want to have responsibility. They don't want to be loyal to their employees. They want loyalty from their employees. And I, you know, back to the sales one, I said, do you think your boss cares? And she's like, oh yeah, we're a small business. And you go, of course, because that's how things used to be. You knew who the boss was. He lived in the same neighborhood, had a nicer house, drove nicer cars, did better things, and good on him, but not multiples better. Not the kind of, hey, I'm going to go fly across the country and have dinner at an 11,000 square foot house in the hills worth $23 million and sit with other billionaires. That's not how it was. So when she said, you know, nobody wants to work anymore, you go, no, not the way things are now. Working people do need to have loyalty and dedication from their employers as much as the employer wants from there. It's a partnership. And I go back to, again, this is why I'm such a pro-union advocate. Unions force employers to go, you know what? We don't get to keep all of the wealth. Some of it does have to trickle down. Some of it does have to be shared. Our concerns have to be taken seriously. There's a process for everything. You want to lay off the workforce? There's a process for that. Not just Elon Musk decided one day, well, you know what? We don't need 10%. The rest of you are just going to have to work harder. And that may have been great, you know, 20 years ago. May have worked. But how many of those kind of scenarios do you get before finally you burn the workforce out? You burn society out. And I say this is where we are. Coming out of the pandemic after all of this, and especially this messaging that you working people, you're all lazy. You don't want to work anymore. And the truth is I don't want to work for poverty and wages in desperate conditions. I don't. Especially when all of the benefit is going to the top 10%, to the Elon Musks, to the David Sachses, to the Michael Milkins. Question is what are we going to do about it? I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Gene Ross from the Center for American Progress is going to be here to share some thoughts on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Did it live up to all of its promises? Was it the utopia that they told us it was going to be? Or was it just like every other tax cut that we've seen? Rich people getting richer. You, me, and the rest of us, well, not so much. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we heat up to election time, one of the big things that the Trump folks are going to talk about is their only real accomplishment during the 4 years. Well, that's not true. Their only legislative accomplishment during the 4 years that Trump was in office was that big tax thing, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And there's going to be a lot of talk about, did it work? Did it not work? I argue worked perfectly, made the rich richer. But that's what they're going to run on. You know, did this work? Is this what we want more of? And here to share some thoughts on, well, what did happen with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is why I've asked Gene Ross to come talk with us. She's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where she focuses on economic policy. They got a piece out. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act failed to deliver the promised benefits. Gene, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Nice to join you this evening.
So you're saying that the Trump promises that we were going to cut taxes, raise revenues, everything was going to be utopian. We were going to invest in infrastructure and higher paying jobs and all this stuff. And that finally, the tax cuts for the very wealthy would then wash down, trickle down, if you will, on the rest of us. Did that happen?
Well, first, let's step back and go back to 2017. And there was a large, huge tax cut. A part of it went to individuals, as you mentioned, disproportionately the wealthy, and about a quarter in terms of the size of the initial tax cut of that measure was dedicated to cutting corporate taxes. And my new paper that's out today looks at a lot of the really audacious promises that the then president and his economic advisors made about what they anticipated would be the benefits of the bill. To get to the punchline, those promises have not been borne out by the evidence. And in fact, we haven't seen trickle down in terms of wages of low and middle income workers. We haven't seen profits come back on shore. And we didn't see a huge bump in economic growth
because of these tax cuts. I mean, because your wages have come up at the bottom during the Biden years because of, a lot of union organizing and the tight labor force. There have been some at the bottom, and I would argue because of the policies of this administration, not because of these tax cuts.
Yes, and that's really just been the last year or two with the tight labor market that we've seen under President Biden. But what my paper does is really go through some really, really fascinating economic research that's taken advantage of all the things that researchers can do today with big data. And some economists associated, with the Joint Committee on Taxation of Congress, Federal Reserve Board, looked at actually what happened in individual firms. And they asked, did wages increase? And if so, where in the earnings distribution did we see those gains go? And what they found is that for the bottom 90% of the within firm earnings distribution, there were no benefits, no trickle down due to the tax cuts, corporate tax cuts. But what we did see is substantial boosts, the top 10% of the earnings distributions, particularly managers, executives, and certainly shareholders as well.
So when they grew the pie, they took more of it. I get it. So, but here's the thing. Have these tax cuts ever worked out as they were promised? I mean, my entire life, the Republican Party, their fetish has been, we got to cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes. And what they keep selling us is, we're going to cut taxes. The smart people, we're going to give them all the money because they're smart and they know what to do with it. And then they're going to grow this enormous pie and we're going to all get some of it. That, in my view, hasn't really worked out. But in your looking at the data, looking at the research, have you found that these tax cuts have ever produced the kind of results that they claim they would?
No, and a lot of the claims that we heard back 2016, early 2017, as Congress considered this bill, were sort of the standard tropes that tax cuts would pay for themselves, that we'd see economic growth, we'd see trickle down. And so I think, as you alluded to in the introduction, I think a lot of us assume what we have seen is exactly what would happen. But it's always go back, you need to check your facts. And I think what this paper is designed to do is to inform the debate over this bill. The individual tax cuts, the tax cuts that benefited wealthy heirs, those were made temporary in the original bill. The corporate cuts were made permanent. But I think as we begin to, and the temporary cuts expire the end of 2025, what a lot of us would like to see is for the bill as a whole, not just the tax cuts for people, also the corporate tax cuts to be back on the table and revisited in light of the evidence over the next year and a half.
Yeah, because again, you're saying that this overwhelmingly benefited corporations and the very wealthy, because obviously the very wealthy own the corporations. Did it help the average worker? I mean, I talk to people often who believe, and it's a belief thing. It's not a, hey, I can point to facts and here, there's this. It's a belief that I'm better off because of these tax cuts, because the narrative has been these tax cuts were focused for the working class. Even though I know that's not true, but that was the narrative that was sold back then.
And again, in this paper looks at the tax cuts that initially benefited corporations. But what economics tells us is that corporations pass on the benefits of those tax cuts to people, to shareholders. And in traditional economic theory, and we're getting into, you know, some advanced economics here, potentially to workers. But what this new research does is really probe deeper, and it does it with data and techniques that weren't available back when I was in graduate school. And again, it what the researchers find is that all of the benefits went to the top of the earnings distribution. Managers, executives went to shareholders. And I think what's particularly important when we look at the global economy that we hear about so much these days, what they found is a little more than one out of every $6 of that very costly tax cut, corporate tax cut, actually went to foreigners who owned shares of U.S. corporations. So it, you know, flowed out of the U.S. to foreign owners of the stock in U.S. corporations.
Now, you talk about the temporary tax cuts. Who were those temporary tax cuts targeted towards? I know the corporate ones are permanent, but who are those temporary tax cuts? Were those cuts for, people, working people? Were those temporary cuts for, you know, the estate tax stuff or the very wealthy? Who were those targeted at?
Those cuts were across the board, but the largest tax cuts, you know, went to the very top of the earnings distribution, went to the wealthiest Americans, got the largest of those tax cuts.
Right. The reason I asked that, Gene, is because, you know, I know a lot of people who say, well, I got a tax cut. And I keep saying that, you know, there's the sunset provisionist that eventually they end. So any benefits that working people may have gotten out of this in 2017, and as you pointed out, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2025, that this stuff goes away, and we end up back where we were. But corporate America, their tax cuts are forever.
Yes, I think, you know, and what we anticipate is that Congress is going to look very closely at that bill and decide what parts of the temporary tax cuts they want to keep and what part do they want to expire. And how do they pay for it? Because if you take these tax cuts, the so-called Trump tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts before them, those tax cuts are responsible for the entire growth in the debt ratio for the country. If you take away one-time spending for emergencies like the pandemic. So they put a tremendous burden on the federal budget, diverted revenue that could otherwise go to stabilize Social Security, you know, make a stronger economy, pay for childcare, do things that would benefit all Americans.
Now, in your conclusion, you're right, and I agree. The law did, however, significantly reduce corporate tax collections, divert resources from public investments to the pockets of wealthy shareholders, executives, and high-paid workers. And as if that was, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, as if that was a negative outcome. I argue that's exactly what it was supposed to do. This is the goal of a lot of these things, to starve the public sector of the resources that it needs to invest in roads and bridges and, you know, the things that we the people need, and to enrich, well, the campaign donors. This stuff seems to me to be working perfectly.
Absolutely. All the projections Congress knew who would be the likely beneficiaries. I think they perhaps believe that somehow magically there would be growth. And again, the paper that we released today shows didn't actually occur, but absolutely. And I think it's important also for your listeners to go back. This bill was passed without a single Democratic vote through the Congress. And now, you know, Congress will have a chance to take a second look.
Well, that's because, and I know my red hat crowd will go, that's because, you know, liberals have never found a tax that they don't like because they're tax and spend. And I go, look, you know, I'm a big supporter of tax and spend. I believe in paying our bills. I look at this and this is, you know, borrowing and spending, because our spending didn't go down during the Reagan or during the Reagan, Bush, Trump years at all. And yet our revenue collection didn't keep up.
No, I mean, this was a tax cut that wasn't paid for itself, was never intended to pay for itself, and has pushed the deficit higher.
Have any of them, have any of these tax cuts really been paid for?
Yeah, we've seen some smaller ones that have been, but in general, I think it's no. The answer is in general for the big waves of tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, absolutely not.
Because the reason I bring this up is, you know, we're told that, you know, we can cut taxes. It's kind of like, you know, we can have cake and eat it too. We can cut taxes, we can continue to spend, and everything's going to work out, because by cutting taxes, we're going to raise revenue, which seems weird. But in some mental gymnastics, they've gotten a lot of people to believe it. And I'm just trying to make sure that I'm on the right page, because that math never added up for me, even though it's what we've been sold.
And it hasn't added up for the federal budget.
So where do we go with this information? What are you hoping people take from this in the move forward to right our tax? Because, good luck, I think a lot of people are concerned about the federal budget, the deficits and the debt. And look, we still need things. We need roads and bridges. We need to fund our military. We need to do a lot of things. Where is there a path forward in this? Is there a prescription that you're relying on that will help us maybe go in the right direction?
There is a path forward. I think lawmakers don't want to see all of the temporary tax cuts, the ones for lower and middle income families, to expire. So that will be a forcing event, the expiration of the tax cuts for people. And I think the big question is now, you know, can we, through good public policy arguments and persuasion, bring Congress to the table to look at the full bill? And what are the outcomes of that debate? Can we use the expiration of the 2017 tax cuts to actually build a more fair tax code, one where the highest income people pay their fair share of financing government? Can we look at things like extending the expanded child tax credit, such as the one we had in 2021, which did so much to stabilize families, improve their economic well-being, lift children out of poverty? So we have a big opportunity over the next year and a half to look at our tax code, both the one that applies to individuals, also to businesses, and how do we make sure that we have the money we need to pay for infrastructure, Medicare, Social Security, and our pressing national priorities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at budgets, they're a moral document. And the fact that a lot of them, you know, based on what side you're on, one seems fairly immoral. And you brought up the child tax credit, and nothing makes me angrier than the fact that they forced that to expire. And in the worst possible time, right after Christmas, they ripped away that small amount of money from families. It's just and doubled childhood poverty in this country. It's infuriating.
And again, I think those are the kinds of trade-offs that Congress needs to consider over the next 18 months.
And in fact, you know, the police are coming right now to go get those people.
Sorry.
At least I hope. No, look, at the end of this, and I've said this before, look, I was a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I grew up in poverty. So the thing is, I didn't know there was a better way. We didn't have food at the end of the month. You wouldn't know it by looking at me now. But we went through some of that stuff. So I know what that's like. But I can't imagine what it would have been like as a kid had you shown me that there was a better way, that there was an option, that there could be food at the end of the month, that you could have security in knowing that you're not going to get evicted because you fell behind on the rent, or you're not going to get the lights turned off because you got this little bit of money to help you through, and then to have it ripped away. That stings.
And again, maybe I'm an idealist, but I think, again, we have a body of evidence that shows just how important that was for families, how it helped, you know, families save a little bit of money in case of emergency, how it helped them stay in their homes, what it means for children who are, after all, our future. And we have evidence on these corporate tax cuts that show that they didn't work and they didn't do what they were promised to do. So let's look at the facts and let the debate go forward.
There you go. Gene Ross, I appreciate you taking time for me. I hope folks will take a look at the report. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act failed to deliver promised benefits. We'll get links out from the Center for American Progress's website. Gene, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Increasing clouds in the overnight. By sunrise, we'll be in the upper 40s, and shower chances will be on the increase. And that rain will continue into Thursday. Some rumbles of thunder possible as well. Breezy, some heavy rain, and highs in the upper 50s. Currently 52 degrees.
Earl Ingram.
In Wisconsin, parents pay one-third of their income on childcare. Think about what we need our income for. Shelter, food, clothing, gas bill, electric bill. And we're talking about one child. This is a crisis. Young families are saddled with what is almost impossible to deal with.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're seeing a lot of news about voucher programs, these voucher schemes across the country. I know in my state of Pennsylvania, hotly contested, lots of money, lots of billionaire money going into making sure that these golden tickets are available generally for the people who are already sending their kids to private schools. Kind of nice little windfall, a little Christmas bonus, if you will. But, you know, what are these things? Why are they? And are there some people who are trying to take advantage of it? And I'm looking at this thing in Iowa. Iowa just passed a voucher scheme, and one of their state representatives, weeks after the bill passes, he goes and starts up a private Christian school. And here to share some thoughts on maybe on this and why, and is this legal? I've asked our good friend, Iowa State Representative J.D. Scholten, to come talk with us. J.D., thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So I'm looking at this state representative. His name's Dean Fisher, Republican from Montour, I guess, county there. They're starting up this Tama Toledo Christian school, and he's admitted, look, the only way it's going to run is we're getting state money. Is this legal?
Apparently it is. The voucher system, the whole thing is a scam. You know, I was at a... I'm trained for baseball. I go to my local public high school to use their facility, and they had a tennis match with the local private school. And here, I mean, no fault, like one of the tennis players for the private school, she leaves. I noticed the student leaving in probably like a $40,000-$50,000 car. And the only thing that popped up in my head right away was, well, first, it was that super nice car. I couldn't even probably afford it. And then the second thing that popped in my head, oh, I bet you they're eligible for this voucher program. and they don't seem to need it. And so it's just, the whole thing is just a mess. And we're already 20 to 30 million dollars over budget in year one. And we're expected to be 400% over budget in just a few years. And there's no auditing. There's no mandatory reporting to see where this money is going to make sure that it's being used properly or anything like that. And there's no cap. So this is a blank check to a third party out-of-state corporation to manage private schools right now. And it's taxpayer money. And then you got this guy trying to make a dime, creating his own private school. And it's just, meanwhile, in his very county, in the same area that he represents, there's the school district is $1 million underwater, and they're having to share staff with their district next to them, like so many rural districts, because they're struggling with attendance.
See, this is one of those things that I think is a rural, really, for Democrats to go into rural communities and talk about, they're destroying your local public schools. They're destroying that thing that brings communities together on Friday nights and brings them together of having some shared community. This sounds like a winning issue for Democrats to get involved in.
Oh, absolutely. Like, the other part of it too is, you look at the state of Iowa, our state quarter says foundation in education. We used to be so proud and prideful of our education. When I graduated high school, we were first in the nation in education. And there's one year we dropped below Minnesota and everybody freaked out. And we all was like, okay, what do we got to do to go back to number one? And now we're middle of the pack at best. We are underfunding public education now that we have a Republican trifecta for over a decade now. And it just goes to show that when the voucher program passed last year, my school district, the Sioux City School District, said it's going to be an 8% budget cut directly to us because of this. So we are paying for rich kids to go, and it's not all rich kids, but it's two-thirds of the I think the article mentioned, two-thirds of the kids who are going to use these vouchers were already going to private schools. So right. It's not like all these new kids are jumping on board. And so when you have this, who does it hurt? It hurts public schools. It hurts kids with needs, special needs kids, because private schools don't have to accept them, and they can kick anybody out when they want. And that was one thing we heard in the debate for this, is there is one school that bragged about having 100% graduation rate. Well, the reason they have that is because if you're not going to graduate, they'll kick you out of school a month before graduation. So that doesn't do anybody any good.
Well, so, it does. It does them good. And ultimately, right. From what I hear from the voucher advocates, is this is a pushback to the woke agenda, that they're gonna pursue good Christian values. We're going to bring the Bible back. We can get rid of that science book, and we can teach good moral values. That seems to be the argument for this, as social media and a lot of moneyed interest are pushing this idea that your local public school is a mess. We've got to do away with it, and we've got to get back to traditional values. And the argument is privatized and profitized schools is that way. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, there was a bill this year that we argued and it ended up passing, which drives me nuts. But it was on making sure the social studies curriculum is really emphasizing Western civilization. And what was really funny is the two people who stood up on the Republican side, they're really advocate for it and showed like what it means that like they didn't learn the stuff growing up. That they needed to, and it was only later in life that they found out about some of the stuff. Well, you look at, like, it doesn't have Native American history in there. It doesn't have anything like MLK or the Tuskegee Airmen or the Tulsa Massacre or the things that are very important in our Black community history. But I wanted to go up and just stand up and ask, well, you guys are complaining that you didn't learn about this. Did you go to an Iowa high school? And neither one of them are originally from Iowa. And there is this right-wing agenda of trying to just, it's their whitewashing our education system. And it's like the beauty of America is you got to learn from your past and live up to the ideals that this country was founded in. And that's like just whitewashing our past doesn't make everything better. It's not going to end racism. And it just like so frustrating to see where this state and where this country is going when you know, the freedom to learn is just something that like I took for granted as a kid. But then when I got to college, I was a history major. But what they really taught me was to question what you're learning and to question the authority. And so I've really took to that being kind of an anti-establishment person. It just like to me, that's history.
Right. No, look, I've said from the beginning, I want my kids to be taught actual history, not the soft stuff, which is why back in 2015, you know, when my daughter came home and said, you know, she learned about Rosa Parks. And what she learned is, well, she's tired. You know, she was tired, which was not exactly what the teacher taught her. It's what she got out of it. You know, over that summer, we did a civil rights tour as part of the program. And we went to the places where there was, you know, Black history. And it wasn't good. And, yeah. You know, we didn't sanitize much of it. The really, really ugly stuff since they were kids, we did. But, you know, the reality is I want actual history taught. This stuff was bad. It was horrible. I didn't do it, but you learn about it so you don't allow it to happen again. And I fear by not learning about how bad it was, we can justify a way perhaps doing it again in the future.
Right. I mean, the fact that like the Florida is banning books on Jackie Robinson,
yeah,
you know, like when it comes to racism in our, the history of America, you know, it's not necessarily our fault what happened, but it's our responsibility to take on to show, okay, no, this is the direction we're going. We are too good of a nation for this. And it just, like, again, the wrong direction.
Yeah, I want to go back to this guy, you know, starting this voucher school. Because, you know, the part that's interesting to me is these vouchers in your state, as it's been reported, are worth about $7,800 next year. Yeah. Which, you know, sounds like a lot of money. I don't know that in the private school setting it is. Because I asked when, you know, years ago, it's probably been 12, 13 years since we had Senator Fulmer on this show, who was the first guy to bring the voucher scheme into Pennsylvania. And he told me that the golden ticket, if my kid got this golden ticket, that they could go to any private school in the state and the cost would be paid for, the transportation would be paid for, all that. And it's going to be great. But when you read his bill, it was what the school district was paying. And these vouchers, as you have in the state, looks like $7,800. I see this as just another way of enriching the very wealthy and creating these religious-centric schools to destroy public education. This is about destroying more of the commons and privatizing education so that they can get their hands into the till. Am I being hyperbolic? Am I being paranoid? Oh. Or is this
no, that's
what
exactly
you do?
What's happening in the state? Yeah, no, you're that's exactly what's happening. So the other aspect of it that I don't think it's the light gets shined on it enough is the money doesn't necessarily go to the parents or the student or anything. It goes to a third party corporation, and so they get their cut, and so. And for us, it's when they decided on the bill and as we were debating it, they could not name who that company was. So it's just, we're going to have our faith in some company that we don't know and ends up being out of state. And it just, it makes no sense. It just fiscally, it was the most fiscally irresponsible bill ever to pass in the state of Iowa.
Is it that they didn't know or they didn't want to tell you?
Well, they didn't want to tell us. They'll say they didn't know and they trust the system and whatever. It's a scam, and you know, a lot of people are going to get rich off this, and that's the part that I like don't think it's highlighted enough when it comes to this. But I mean, you talk about this Representative Dean Fisher, and I've worked on him. We were in natural resources together. He had a bill. It ended up not being passed or anything like that, but he had a bill to put bounties on raccoons. So if you killed a raccoon, brought it in, you'd get $5. And like, just, I mentioned that recently to an event I spoke at, a post-legislative event, actually for lunch today, and people started smirking a little bit about that. And I just said, you know, we're just really not bringing our best. And I think that's the number one thing that I realized about being at the state legislature is, like, you know, you look across and like, what made these people what is it about the state of Iowa that you're like, this is the answer, this is the direction we need to go down? And it's what's happening in the Capitol is so far removed from what the people want and what the people needs are. That's the thing that is bothering me. But it also, where there's crisis, there's opportunity. And I'm looking at across the state, people are fed up. And so I'm hoping the Democratic Party can really get back to its roots, go door knocking, go person to person, town to town, home to home, and just really start getting the message out there and start winning back some of these seats.
So, but what do you say then, you know, because, you know, I've heard this, you know, this voucher thing, this privatization move has to happen because the public schools have just gotten too woke. They're too liberal. The teachers are having cat boxes in the bathroom and teaching, you know, all that stuff to kids. We got to stop that. We got to stop these liberal woke teachers. How do you go into these rural communities like mine and explain to people that, you know, there's not a cat box in every classroom? It's not what you've been fed on the outrage channels that the right controls. It's not the narrative that's being pumped, that they're actually doing the hard work and the good work of educating the next generation of critical thinkers. How do you make that jump then? Because the narrative I find is really, really strong.
Right. I think there's two things. The first thing is, look at who's feeding you that message. It's huge multinational corporations that want your attention and want you upset. And they have every incentive to grab your attention by doing something outrageous and it's not truthful. And again, this gets back to that one corporation, which has ties to Betsy DeVos, already a billionaire, is going to profit off of all of this. And so, like, just follow the money. That's the one side of it. The other side of it is, go to a parent-teacher conference. You know, go talk to your teachers. The teachers are hardworking. The more they're just being demonized right now, we're seeing people doing early retirement just because they're like, I'm tired of this crap. It's just, let teachers teach. You know, I don't go into your job and tell you what to do all the time, but like, it's not like they're hiding anything. There's parents-teacher conferences. There's PTAs. We elect school boards to all take care of this. Like, there's a democratic process on our public education. And so it's so frustrating. But again, it gets back to, you're exactly right. That ecosystem that's there is feeding into this. But folks, you got to follow the money.
Yeah, but JD, no, it's not my school. My school's good. My teacher's good. It's all those other ones. You know, the ones I don't know about, the ones that I've never been to, the ones that I've never seen, but I've been told they're bad.
Yep, exactly right.
It's crazy. It's crazy where we are. And there's part of me goes, you know, maybe they're right. I look at all these people who have bought into this stuff. Maybe our education system does need to teach more critical thinking.
Well, here's the thing that we're seeing with, and you're seeing this all across the nation. Republicans are for free speech unless it's some sort of left free speech. They're for freedoms, but then when it comes to like reproductive freedoms, they're not for that freedom. And it's just, they're picking and choosing. And it's not we're for this regardless. It's picking and choosing and really just dissecting what they really want. And it's this one day, it's this another day, it's this another day. And you know,
as I always say, they want rights. They want their rights.
Right.
Just not you to have any rights.
Exactly.
It's about their rights, not yours. So last question I've got, how big of an issue do you think this is across the country? And what should voters think about come November?
Well, I think we had two very, in the last 2 years, my 2 years in the legislature, and we were all in the House for re-elections here in November. this, the voucher is one of, like I said, it's the most fiscally irresponsible bill ever passed. So any Republican trying to run on fiscal responsibility that was in the House or the Senate and voted for this bill, they are not fiscally responsible whatsoever. The other thing we had was the AEAs, the Area Education Agencies. Each state's a little different, but this just supplied, it helped with special education. For me, when I was growing up, I had frequent ear infections that caused me to have a speech impediment when I was young. And before I got to school age, I went to an AEA. They got me with a speech therapist that got me to the appropriate age development. That ended up helping me get into school, and they completely dismantled it. And nobody asked for this. And we got thousands on both bills. We got thousands of emails. And with the vouchers, I mean, kids who already go to private schools, there's a few, like the Catholic schools were really for it. And so we got maybe 3 to 5% of our emails were supportive of it. But when it came to the AEA bill, we got over 5,000 this year emails, and not one of them were for it. So you add that up all together, people are feeling this. And so I think it's a huge deal, and it's a huge opportunity for Democrats to win back seats at the state level
here. I'm right there with you, JD. I appreciate the time. Keep up the good work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Our good friend J.D. Scholten, Iowa State Representative. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you have these schemes in your neck of the woods? And anybody who has them, who's in favor, I want to hear from you. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day that workers throughout the United States walked off their jobs in a coordinated, planned effort and demanded the 8-hour day. What made this strike truly revolutionary was that the workers were not asking for reduced pay for reduced hours. They wanted their pay level to stay the same. Chicago labor activist Alan Parsons explained this that March for the Chicago Daily News, saying, quote, "The movement to reduce the work hours is intended by its projectors to give a peaceful solution to the difficulties between capitalists and laborers. I have always held that there were two ways to settle this trouble, either by peaceable means or violent methods. Reduced hours, or 8 hours, is the peace offering. Fewer hours mean more pay. Reduced hours is only the measure of economic reform, which consults the interests of the laborers as producers, which can only be acquired by possessing and consuming a larger share of their own project. This would diminish the profits of the exploiters." That first day of May, tens of thousands took to the streets in Chicago, and an estimated 300,000 protested across the nation, marching for the 8-hour day. The strike met with early success, but then 3 days later, an unknown person threw a bomb at a workers' rally in Chicago's Haymarket Square. The government crackdown against the 8-hour movement was quick and harsh. 8 men stood trial in Chicago for the bombing. 4 were martyred despite a lack of evidence tying them to the bomb. But the idea of the 8-hour day was not so easily crushed. It spread not only in the United States, but across the world. Now, more than a century later, May Day, this day is the International Workers' Holiday. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, this story out of Iowa is just, it's just heartbreaking because, as JD pointed out, Iowa had one of the best education systems in the country several years ago. And now you get these right-wing zealots who are in there who, look, I love the way you put it. You know, we're not sending our best and brightest because, you know, who are these people? Well, they're the folks who could raise the money. They're the people who could get the billionaire backers to help fund them. The Betsy DeVos's, the Jeffrey Yaz's of the world. And it's on this voucher issue. You know, I happened to be talking to someone the other day and I said, you know, look, you know, we could make a ton of money if we just sold our soul on this one issue. You know, this one issue of vouchers, we could get, you know, tons of billionaire money. And they would go, well, yeah, that's not such a good idea. I agree. But the reason I said it is because, look, there's a lot of funding out there. There's a lot of money being thrown around in the churches and a lot of money thrown around in media and a lot of money being thrown into these places that are respected so that you constantly hear the message. The incentive for these different organizations and institutions to be okay and want vouchers is in their radical self-interest. You know, you get these churches go, hey, we could start a religious school. You get these media groups go, hey, you know, there's the charter school people who advertise and the voucher people there, those private schools, they're going to advertise too. You know, nothing drives me crazier than driving down the road hearing an ad on the radio for such and such a school, because I know that's my tax dollars at work and not in a good way. So when I look at this, I go, you know, the time and repetition that has happened over the last 10 years, I go back to the governor's race. I'm going to say 06. Hardy Williams, the senator from Philadelphia, state senator, got millions of dollars from the charter school people to run on that very issue. And he ran a gubernatorial race. He was never going to win. But it was about pushing that issue. It was about getting that issue out into the media and into people's minds, going, hey, we could have a shiny door new school, you know, and get the same education that the rich people are getting. And you go, no, it's not that. You're not getting that. You're going to get shiny doors and uniforms and strict discipline, but you're going to get creaming, which is, you know, if your kid can't keep up, well, we're going to keep them long enough to get the money and then send them back to the underfunded public school without actually doing anything to make their lives better. Or we're going to push them into cyber charters. And all of the craziness that's happened and the criminality that's happened in that world. But it's about the money. And for parents, because you hear this, well, they don't want us parents having choice. And it's not about choice. I don't want the choice between a scheme school and an underfunded school. I don't want the choice between an ideologically driven school that, you know, it's all about the dollars and cents and the cash, and a school that's struggling to keep the lights on or having to share staff. I want one really well-funded, quality, local public school. That's what I want. It's what we had for a while. We did before the Milton Friedmanites decided, no, this segregation stuff, you know, we want it. And if they're not going to give it to us, we're going to do it in education. And this is when all of this push for, you know, vouchers and charters and all of this stuff. Now, look, I'm not against the idea of schools doing things differently. Originally was in favor of the idea of a public charter school that would focus on an issue. We used to call them magnet schools, where, you know, it's an art school. It's a technology school. Some kids learn differently. You know, I like the Montessori method, more experiential learning. We should be doing that, but in the public space, to where we're not putting a profit motive in there. And that's what this does. This goes ahead and gives us a profit motive. And understand, there are people who are lining their pockets. There are people who are going, hey, real estate deals? Yeah, we'll take that public lands, and we'll take everything the community gives us, and we'll privatize it. So in a couple of years when the school fails, we've got all of this stuff. It's bad, start to finish. And this idea that, oh, we're going to help that poor child. Yeah, there aren't a lot of those cases. Are there some? Maybe. But I think we would help a whole lot more if we invested heavily in our local public schools, especially in areas that have the most need. Maybe a funding formula that took poverty into account, and a little bit more would go to those schools. But I know we can't do that because, well, the narrative, those are woke, liberal, failing schools. We need shiny doorknobs and discipline. I got to tell you, it's a frustrating place that we're in. And for me, as I've said, I want a good, well-funded local public school. And this is, I got to tell you, I think this could be a winning issue in the rural communities where the school is the center of that community. having money taken away and seeing art programs and music and physical activities taken away. I think Democrats, if they do this right, this could be their issue for the next election. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast or go to freespeech.org and find the video. But as always, appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.